Welcome to this podcast, which is produced for the Norwegian Youth Atlantic Treaty Association's annual Nordic Security Conference. Today's topic is another follow-up podcast with one of the participants from NORSEC, this time about jihadist terrorism in Europe. My name is Emil Klasaugen, and with me today is Petter Nesser. Welcome, Petter, and thank you so much for agreeing to do this follow-up podcast with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Petter is a senior researcher at the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment and an associate professor at the Norwegian Business School. He has conducted extensive research on European jihadism for more than a decade. Petter is author of the book Islamist Terrorism in Europe. I want to begin on something from your opening statement in NORSEC. You said that it is a misconception that jihadi terrorism is a small problem compared to right-wing and nationalist terrorism. Could you please elaborate a little bit on this?
Yeah, I want to start by offering some context to the question. I've been working on monitoring transnational militant Islamist terrorism in Europe, or jihadism, since the mid-2000s. And during that time, I have collected information about both launched attacks and also foiled plots by these networks for a long time. And I have noticed over the last few years that even during the big wave of attacks and plots by Islamic State in Europe in 2014 to 2017, there were multiple articles, expert interviews, op-eds, referring to mostly data from Europol and also the Global Terrorism Database, saying that jihadi terrorism was a small problem compared to especially nationalist terrorism in the European context. And I remember at the time thinking that this is somewhat absurd, because at the time we were experiencing major, you know, massive deadly attacks, such as the attacks on Bataclan, the truck attack in Nice, the Manchester bombing, and also numerous foiled plots to launch mass atrocities in European cities. And of course, when we are comparing across different terrorism trends or ideologies, it's all about the data and the interpretation of data, right? In my work, I focus on Western Europe only on jihadism, and I use a narrow definition of terrorism. So there should be an organized effort to launch deadly attacks on you know, civilian, but also of course military symbols or other symbols of state and so forth, but still it should be deadly. That's one of the inclusion criteria. Some of these analyses that pointed to nationalist terrorism being a bigger threat refer to databases that have a very different or wider definition of terrorism. So they include, you know, sabotage and also what we can refer to as hate crime, which is a more spontaneous form of, it can be politicized, but it's different from you know, the kind of terrorism we refer to when we use a narrow definition. So I think this is one of the explanations why I think it's a misconception to use numbers based on a wide definition and compare them with data based on a narrow definition. We are comparing a very different phenomena. We risk, you know, comparing apples and oranges, because although nationalist terrorism causes brutal attacks and tragedies and it's a serious problems where it happens, it's still confined to national boundaries, right? It's a local threat. Whereas when we are looking at jihadism, it's a transnational threat affecting multiple countries, regions, and in the end, the whole world. And you also see that jihadists launch attacks that more often are indiscriminate, whereas nationalist terrorists are targeting representatives of the state mainly. And usually their operations are less lethal.
So based on what you're saying, that there is a misconception now that jihadi terrorism is diminishing at the moment. Because I, for one, do have this conception, mostly based on what I have read in the media, as well as how Norwegian intelligence, for example, now considers right-wing terrorism as a bigger threat to Norwegians. Is this based perhaps on how it's more important for media to get like a headline where saying like, oh, Norway is more threatened now by nationalist terrorism, while, as if I understand you correctly, the jihadi threat is more globalist, so in the bigger picture it's a larger threat?
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's variations from country to country as well. So in a country such as Norway, we haven't had the kind of threat levels we have seen on the European continent in countries such as France, the UK, and Germany when it comes to jihadi terrorism. And we had a major brutal attack by Anders Behring Breivik and also the attempted attack by Manshaus recently, which, of course, are very major events, whereas from jihadi terrorists, we have had some plots, but not of the same scale, right, in the Norwegian context. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that there have been reports from various European countries, for instance, the UK, that that the UK security services see right-wing terrorism as the fastest growing trend. Or this was reports from, I think, 2019 or 2020. But still, it's growing from a level which is much lower than, you know, the jihadi threat we have been living with since the 1990s. So we have to keep two ideas in the mind at the same time here. And also, it depends on if you are focusing on the West as such, and you if you include countries such as Australia and New Zealand, where you had the Christchurch attack, and also the US, where the threat from right-wing extremism and right-wing militancy or nationalism or anti-system extremism has a much longer and very different history from modern Western Europe, right? Although, of course, we have seen in this region also, or very high levels of right-wing extremism during and also after the Second World War, of course. But then we have seen a declining trend when it comes to right-wing terrorism before we have witnessed an uptick in this type of terrorist incidents or also an uptick in political violence from the far right in recent times. But even though that is a fact, it's not comparable levels to what we have seen from jihadism from the mid-1990s through the 2000s and especially now in the 2010s.
So it sounds like perhaps we're giving a lot of attention to the rising threat, even though, based on what you're saying, it isn't nearly as large as the threat we're still seeing from jihadi terrorism.
Yeah, but when we are looking at the threat from the far right, it's comparable also in some ways to jihadism, right? And it's a major concern, of course, because this is an ideological threat, right? And it's transnational. That's also a similarity with jihadism. But I think a major difference between the two in terms of generating international terrorism is that jihadism has become an integrated part of local armed conflicts throughout the world. And this is something that for one generates recruitment capacity and also triggers attacks on the international arena, because jihadists are using these attacks for different purposes linked to their various local struggles.
So to follow up on what you said about recruitment, because we have already talked about the crucial importance of the internet in this podcast regarding online activism during the Arab Spring and beyond. So how has the internet shaped the jihadi networks around the world?
So it's been a major factor in the rise and evolution of jihadism from dating back to the 1990s. And jihadists were extremely innovative and early on in using these instruments, using websites and social media from day one. So it has played a major role, and even more so since the late 2000s, when there was a major operation to shut down many major websites and forums run by jihadists. And at that time, there was this call from the propagandists and the recruiters that we should now all move to the mainstream channels. So this was when the mainstream channels such as Twitter and Facebook were populated by transnational militant Islamists. And this was, of course, a few years before the major mobilization that we saw from 2011, 2012, in connection with the Arab Spring and the outbreak of the war in Syria. And it became a major vehicle for the massive mobilization of European foreign fighters to Syria and Iraq, who first joined Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups and then moved on to joining IS, when IS became the major actor in the region. So it's very important to not underestimate the role mainstream social media has played in recruitment. But a more recent development is that these social media communication apps have become a more important tool in one-to-one recruitment processes. So you basically see that terrorist cells and networks are formed virtually to an extent that we never saw in the past. In the past, there were much more a mix of offline and online interaction, whereas now we can see that terrorist cells are formed online and that terrorists are instructed via social media app even when they are attacking, you know, during the process and also in the process leading up to an attack, of course.
Just to go back a little bit, you talked about recruitment, and this is more of a me being curious, because I have seen some really well-made recruitment videos for ISIS where they make it seem like being a foreign fighter is more or less like playing Call of Duty. Do these videos actually work?
Yeah, I do think so, but I don't have any evidence to back it up. I think it just based on looking at the various propaganda items and the different things out there. And also when we know that more and more about the social background of the European foreign fighters that went to Syria and Iraq, you know that there were many young people, and this is also reflected in international terrorism now, where we have seen in recent times, you know, many plots and attacks executed by very young individuals. Like, for instance, a very recent case here in Norway with an IS supporter, 16-year-old, trying to make poison to use in a terrorist attack. So the hypothesis is that absolutely this has been effective, but I don't have, you know, the evidence of someone saying that these were the propaganda items that made me join IS or made me pledge loyalty to Baghdadi.
I'm not going to make that link too strong, but we do see the Norwegian army, for example, doing a lot of videos lately where they show tanks and people shooting and so on. And in many ways, they're playing on the same sentiments when they're doing their recruitment, even though it's obviously two widely different organizations.
Yeah, and we know that IS recruitment was very successful just by the sheer scale of the organization and how effective it was in drawing foreign fighters from, especially from the MENA region, but also from the West. And so it's a very plausible connection between the tools they have used and the propaganda items they have produced and this successful recruitment. Mm-hmm.
I want to move deeper into your research, because at NORSEC, you talked about three types of militants that have been operating in Europe: drifters, misfits, and entrepreneurs. Whereas you said that the latter group have been largely understudied, even though they supposedly are the most important group in successfully building terror cells. Could you quickly remind us what sort of person we find in each group? And then explain to us why academics and governments aren't prioritizing these entrepreneurs.
mean, this is a typology that I used in my work, basically to understand the dynamics of terrorist cells operating in Europe. And I noticed that there were some of the people involved had a much more important role than others in building the cell, educating the cell, socializing the people involved, connecting them to international networks. And these people differ systematically from the others involved. So very early on, kind of grouped this into misfits because there always was some individual in a cell who had a troubled background. For instance, being a criminal or having had problems with drugs or something like that, or not fitting in a school environment and so on. And then there were others again who didn't have those characteristics, but they still differed very much from the entrepreneurs who were, you know, more resourceful and ideological and such. So I call them drifters because usually they ended up in a cell mostly because they knew someone on the inside. So they drifted in through via their social networks. Whereas with the entrepreneurs, I noticed that they were more like a lengthy radicalization process, seemed to me more intellectual, you know, more reading ideology, proactively trying to connect with organized militant networks and groups and such. So, and of course, this is not unique to jihadism. You can see the same types within crime and or right-wing extremism and so forth. But still, I think this typology captures something important when trying to interpret the data, when we are trying to explain why jihadism happens, when we are trying to explain why people join. So there are three main pathways. It's for the entrepreneurs, they have an ideological pathway to jihadism. The misfits have more of a process where they are trying to deal with their personal problems. And the drifters, they join via social interactions and connections and commitments, right? So these are the three main pathways to extremism, basically. And I think it's kind of universal, but it's still, I look upon jihadism as more of a group phenomenon than right-wing extremism, for instance. And also jihadism is a religio-political phenomenon, but it has a major religious component. And because of that, you need someone that can act as a religious advisor or a religious authority for things to happen. So this is why the entrepreneur role becomes so important in jihadism compared to, for instance, right-wing extremism, where you have a much higher proportion of plots and attacks committed by individuals who act on their own. Although jihadists have also started to act on their own, but they are still more connected to networks and interact more with networks in their radicalization and recruitment process. But the misfits and drifters are the majority, right? And the entrepreneurs are the minority. They are the middle managers. So perhaps this is more of a universal thing as well, that we don't notice the middle managers as much as we notice those on the top who take all the major decisions. You know, we hear a lot about Bin Laden and Baghdadi and, you know, these Zarqawi, these iconic figures. From a social science perspective, we hear a lot about the majority, of course, because they represent the average jihadi. So if you look at all the foreign fighters, for instance, you will try to find the average jihadi among them. And this is, of course, characterized by someone being male, young, often with a criminal background, you know, perhaps not so ideological, and so forth.
But your argument is that these middle managers, as you call them, are essential to these attacks, and that other academics have understudied them, and that perhaps governments aren't prioritizing getting these guys.
I think governments have become much better, at least in recent times, because the entrepreneurs are the recruiters, right? I think governments have over time become better in mitigating recruitment. And I think we can ascribe this to them focusing more on the recruiters and the entrepreneurs. And this has been very effective, especially here in Norway. I think the Norwegian approach has been quite successful in mitigating the activities of these recruiters, and some of them have become jailed. And I think that's a very effective tool. And if you look at a country like the UK, for instance, I think it was a failure to let some of the middle managers in the UK context be so active as they were during especially the 2000s, because that was when you saw the rise of this more overt jihadi activist movement, growing out of the El Muajirun movement and changing name to Islam for UK, which became Sharia for UK, which spread to other countries, Sharia for Belgium, Sharia, and also there was an attempt to establish a Sharia for Norway, which ended up taking in the Prophet's Ummah. So I think a lot has happened in terms of prosecution, laws, how the intelligence agencies or security services are prioritizing their resources. So we are in a much better place today than we were in the mid-2000s, the late-2000s, when we had this major mobilization. I think that this mobilization somehow went under the radar, and it caused major problems because we had this massive flight of people from Europe to Syria and Iraq, and they are now kind of, we are worried that these people would constitute tomorrow's threat, basically.
I see that our time is coming to a close. So your last point there is what I want to finish on, because you also said at NORSEC that the jihadi movement is still going strong and that there have never been more foreign fighters in Europe and jihadis in European prisons. You also said that there is an increase in people coming out of jail that rejoins these networks, creating a potential for a large increase in entrepreneurs, which we now know that are one of the biggest risks for terrorist attacks. Are you expecting a new wave of jihadi terrorism in Europe in the years to come? If yes, how can then the European governments decrease the risk of this scenario? And are they doing anything to try to decrease this risk?
Well, that's a great question. If history is to repeat itself, we will see a coming wave. Because that's the pattern. If you look at it historically, there was a wave in the mid-1990s. There was a wave in the mid-2000s. There was a wave in the mid-2010s. And these waves increased. Each wave was bigger than the last one. And this is the pattern we want to prevent, right? And the X factor is, of course, the effect of the countermeasures that have been introduced over the last few years. And, of course, what is happening on the international arena as well. Because I think that if you are to see a new major wave of jihadi plots and attacks in Europe, this would require a new jihadi proto-state in some conflict zone somewhere, which attract European foreign fighters. So absent this, I don't think we will have a new wave. But what I'm worried about is that governments, decision makers, stop prioritizing, mitigating, or use both soft measures and harder measures to try to prevent remobilizations. Because governments have a lot of fires they have to put out, and they need to prioritize their resources. And it's always, especially when we are not seeing as many attacks as we saw in the period 2014 to 2017. We might come into a situation where we don't prioritize those measures that can help us stem future remobilization. So that's my worry. For the time being, I think it's difficult for jihadists to remobilize in a European setting because European governments are still on the alert. But how this will look in 1 year from now or 2 years from now, if attack or plot levels continue at a relatively low level, I don't know. But that's my concern.
Well, that sounds a little bit uplifting, at least. And I do hope that the people in charge listen to people like you, and then we'll hope that there will be no new Islamic proto-state. I think our time is coming to a close, so I would just want to once again thank you so much for participating in this podcast. It has been really interesting for me and hopefully for our listeners as well. So thank you.
Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced by Yata Norway for NorSec 2021. Make sure to follow Yata on Facebook and Instagram to keep up with our latest events and publications. If you missed out on NorSec, you can find the stream on Facebook.